Gradually, of course, the war was coming to an end by that time, and the Germans were becoming more and more disorganized and dispirited.
Because German troops then were absolutely in chaos. Usually well-disciplined, now they were panicking.
By late October 1918, Germany was reaching the end. Its armies were retreating on the Western Front. Of its allies, the Bulgarians were suing for peace, while the ancient Ottoman Turkish and Austro-Hungarian empires were both disintegrating and defeated. Germany's civilian population was starving, and mutinies broke out in ship after ship in the navy. The Kaiser faced the prospect not just of defeat, but of revolution.
In 1918, when I became a soldier myself, first son of an active officer, I wasn't asked, I was just shoved into the business. I didn't like it at all. In a garrison town south of Frankfurt, I think discipline was getting rather slack. You could see it on the streets when soldiers coming from the front didn't take the pains of saluting officers anymore. They thought the officers running around in the garrison had a very good time, so why should they, the front people, salute them? That was, considering the discipline in the Prussian army, a very great change. And it showed that something was breaking.
Heinrich Buttau was interviewed by the BBC in 1964 during the making of the Great War series. In the autumn of 1918, he was struck by the tension and increasing insubordination shown by the soldiers towards their officers.
My commanding officer was so afraid of a coming revolution that he made me sleep with a gun in his arm in front of his rooms in the night. I had to do that. It was rather uncomfortable. What could I do? He was a nobleman, and shortly before the revolution, he disappeared. And perhaps this experience shows that the German army behind the front was in those days not quite intact anymore.
Things were even worse in Germany's dockyards, where huge numbers of men were crammed below decks in battleships which had sat idle since the Battle of Jutland in 1916. Their crews were bored and restless. By late October, news of German reverses triggered mutinies aboard these castles of steel, the very battleships of which the Kaiser had been so proud and whose construction had alienated Britain and pushed it into the embrace of Germany's enemies in 1914.
What did lead to this mutiny? There were not the slightest trouble on board of our destroyers or submarines or minesweepers. In short words, all the ships which had done the actual fighting and which had suffered the great losses. But with the big ships, the situation was absolutely different. They couldn't do very much. They went to sea, but very seldom they came into action. And as a matter of fact, the last great action had been the Battle of Jutland. That was more than 2 years ago. And so they got angry or nervous, or they didn't like life on board of the big ships anymore. And it was easy for the members of the independent socialist Reichstag party to influence them in a way which these men hoped would lead to a similar development as in Russia.
Edgar Luchting, a German officer in charge of a destroyer in the High Seas Fleet, spoke to the BBC in 1964. His ship was in harbour, in Kiel, on Germany's Baltic coast in October 1918. And it was here that the disorder which would culminate in Germany's collapse began. In late October, the desperate authorities ordered the High Seas Fleet to sea for a suicidal attack on the far superior Allied fleet. Knowing the war was already lost, crews refused to leave port. They ostentatiously disobeyed orders. It was mutiny. To try and prevent the contagion spreading, the infected ships were sent along a canal to Kiel.
And the consequence, of course, was that this sickness spread in Kiel. On the 3rd of November, the first signs of what was coming appeared in Kiel. There was some shooting.
By the 3rd of November, Thousands of mutineers and workers were marching in Kiel, demanding an end to the war. The demonstration spread the following day. Troops sent to disperse the protesters joined them. On the morning of the 5th of November, Edgar Luchting looked out of the window of a house where he was staying with relatives, down to Kiel Harbour, where he could see his destroyer. The red flag, the revolutionary banner, had been hoisted.
It was shock, of course. And perhaps how deeply shocked I was explains better when I tell you that I started smoking. I had practically never smoked before, but now I smoked a whole box of 20 cigarettes, one after the other, without noticing it at all. There were the red flag, there were men whom I didn't know, but they didn't want us on board.
The sailors' mutiny in Kiel escalated into a nationwide rebellion against the Imperial German regime. It triggered a series of protests that just days later, on the 9th of November, forced the Kaiser from office. He abdicated and fled, and his empire vanished with him. On the same day in Berlin, revolutionary authorities proclaimed the birth of the German Republic. 2 days later, the armistice was signed. The guns of the Western Front fell silent.
This is Captain Lennox Albert Knox Boswell, DSO Royal Navy, recording his memories of his time in the Grand Fleet in 1917 and 1918. There was a thick fog that morning. I remember we could only just see the foretop from the quarterdeck, about 100 yards visibility.
10 days after the armistice, on the morning of November the 21st, the mightiest fleet ever to put out to sea from a British port began to stream out of the Firth of Forth, heading for the open waters of the North Sea. They were on their way to a final meeting with the enemy, the German High Seas Fleet. 4 years of war between the two fleets was about to culminate in a humiliating act of submission. One of the terms of the armistice stipulated that the Germans must hand over 70 battleships, cruisers and destroyers. George Wainford and Brian de Courcy Ireland witnessed it.
We went out and we met a German fleet, and they came out in single file. And the Grand Fleet was to port and starboard of them. King George V was on the port flank, and our instructions were nobody got laid on the open deck unless on duty. There's no standing about. Everybody got to be below decks. Everybody got to be at their station.
We were all at a pretty high state of alert because we didn't want any fun games to start or anything like that, or somebody get trigger happy, you see. But nothing like that happened at all. And it all went absolutely according to drill.
Wainford managed to find a porthole and watched as one of the most remarkable days in British naval history unfolded.
I could see through this porthole everything that went on. And there was all these German seamen. There was no discipline, waving flags, waving anything they could get over, bits of bunting, old shirts, anything, just to attract attention. All sitting about, lolling about. The Germans had been told that the British fleet was on the verge of mutinying, and they believed it. Of course, there was nothing, no truth in the rumour. And all of their guns was trained fore and aft. All our guns was trained in on them.
Our own particular officer of the turret allowed 3 or 4 of us to get out on the top of the turret for a couple of minutes and have a look. And the scene was something I'll never forget, with a line of German ships coming down the middle and a line of British ships each side of them.
The British Grand Fleet, strengthened by Allied battleships, formed 2 massive columns, one to the north and one to the south, 6 miles apart. Just before 10 a.m, it met the Germans being led to their surrender by the British light cruiser HMS Cardiff. The Allied columns swung round to point due west, forming an escort on either side of the Germans. Wilfred Davy was aboard HMS Queen Elizabeth. The sight of the two fleets together was one of the most spectacular of the war.
Not only the whole of the Grand Fleet, which consisted of the British fleet, the American battle squadron, and bits and pieces from all the other allies. And in addition to that, all the German high seas fleet as well, all there. It doesn't take much imagination to see what a breathtaking sight that must have been. I know it was to me.
The most imposing thing I saw of the war. All these ships are torpedo boat destroyers, submarines, a lot of auxiliary stuff, all coming up. And there was our ships each side of them, you know, like sheepdogs, making certain they went the right way.
Oh, very imposing. Steering towards each other, these two fleets. Of course, we were far and away the bigger fleet.
Brian de Courcy Island was an officer on board HMS Westcott in 1918.
I don't know how you put it. It was rather a moment for a thing of that size to happen. One never thought that, never dreamt of how the war would end like that.
Lennox Boswell was an officer on HMS Queen Elizabeth, Admiral Sir David Beatty's flagship. He gives a picture of the arrangements made for the surrender a few days later, between Admiral Beatty and German Rear Admiral Hugo Moira.
It was rather an exciting moment for us to see a real live German for the first time. The captain of the fleet received him and led him to the ladder aft down to the CNC's quarters. The route was lined by an escort of Royal Marines with their rifles at the order, and Admiral Moira thought they were a guard of honour for a moment and started walking down with his hand at the salute. But he very quickly realised his mistake and dropped his hand, and I expect was rather crestfallen. I don't think in history any other fleet has ever suffered such a loss of morale as the High Sea Fleet, to surrender without firing a shot.
Memories of the war at sea have been eclipsed by the scale of fighting on the battlefields of the Western Front and elsewhere. But the Royal Navy blockade of Germany, its confinement of the German battleships to harbour, and its battle against the U-boats, who had in turn attempted to blockade Britain, were at least as important as any campaign fought ashore. In a global struggle, mastery of the world's oceans had proved decisive. No one who was there that night ever forgot the sunset. The low, wintry sun appeared particularly large and fiery red as it slipped below the central lowlands west of Edinburgh. The German ships were anchored off Rosyth. Aboard the British ships, bands were playing and the crews celebrated. For Wilfred Davy, on board the Queen Elizabeth with Admiral Beatty, one memory would always stand out.
Queen Elizabeth waited and went in last and sailed up between the moored ships of the fleet. As the QE passed, each ship cheered Admiral Beatty, and he stood on the bridge and received the cheers in succession of all the ships in the fleet. And I can only say that, as far as I'm concerned, it was a very emotional moment.